You're listening to Gamesform's Mobilize and Monetize podcast. Dive into the world of mobile gaming with us as we explore the latest trends and discuss best practices.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Gamesform's Mobilize and Monetize. As always, I'm your host for today's episode, Mariam, head of content here at Gamesform. And today we've got a really, really special guest in the house because we're talking to someone who is from a massive company in the space. And I think, you know, those in the industry could really glean some gems of knowledge here. So joining me today is Ben Pomerad from Ting. Ben, how are you doing?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
Really excited to get your insights today. So kicking right off, you know, I think it's safe to say that many successful franchises have passionate fan bases. In your opinion, Ben, how do you think studios can find the right balance between sort of respecting established gameplay while also bringing in fresh ideas and keeping those in the space engaged? I mean, like I mentioned before, you work for a massive, massive company, so who better to sort of answer this than yourself?
Well, yeah, I think it's a great question. Actually, I work for both big and small companies, and you know, you're pointing to the notion of live ops, basically, where you launch your game, the game is live, you observe whether you reach the KPIs that you set for yourself. And more often than not, you may be a bit disappointed with the early results you were expecting for, and you try to improve all that, right? And then there is very often the temptation, like you mentioned, to radically change whatever you've started to do, to bring big innovations, hoping that you would get, suddenly a massive increase in your engagement or revenues. But what I've discovered at King, which has a slightly different approach, is that more often than not, it's it's more efficient, if you want, to bring small iterative improvements on a daily basis rather than aiming for something very big.
Right.
I think that, you know, the reason for that is that when you release a title, you have players who come to your game and they come for the promise of an experience that you created when you launched that game. So for a game like Candy Crush, we have puzzles, mastery puzzles, and that's the reason why player come to the game.
Right.
So then you can do two things. You can either say, "Oh, I'm going to completely change the gameplay. I'm going to bring some construction meta, or I'm going to bring some different type of experience." Or you could say, "Well, I'm going to try to just focus on what I try to sell for in the first place and try to make it better." And the difference between the two is that if you try to do something really, really new, first, you don't know if the people who are playing your game are going to like it. So you are taking a risk.
Obviously. It's always a gamble, yeah.
Well, it's a gamble. You don't know. You may succeed. And there are examples of companies who do that quite well. But let's say, you make $100 per month with your game. If you're lucky with one big innovation, maybe you will make 20% more. So, you know, $120. And that is very risky. It will probably not happen. But if instead you focus on just improving slightly the things you're making, one person per day, at the end of the year, it's much bigger. I did the calculation before we talked, but if you improve by 1% something every day for 365 days, at the end of the year, it's 37 times bigger.
That's a big number. Yeah.
Well, it's exponential compared to those big things. So I think back to the question, how do you balance the two? I think it's, I'm not saying that you shouldn't innovate or you shouldn't have a vision or aim for something big, but I think you need to find the right balance. So when you have a live game team, you need to probably allocate the bigger portion of your efforts to iterative improvements and a little bit to bigger bets. And of course, you know, that points to the element of data, because in gaming, we are lucky to be able to collect a lot of data about the behavior of people, how do they play your games, and so on. And that's the only way really to know if the things you are doing are working or not. So it's like a iterative loop where you try something, you measure, if it works, you do more, and so on and so forth.
Right. Really interesting stuff there, Benjamin. So I wanted to ask you as well. So, you know, studios often explore new genres or markets to expand their reach. You're sort of versed in this. What are some of the unique challenges that you've identified that, you know, you think companies face when sort of venturing outside the niches that they're used to?
Yeah. Well, again, super interesting question. Many times when you manage a game company and you have one game, two games, think about diversification. Is it important for the stability of my business to have a foot in different places? And some companies have done that very successfully, some large companies. But if you really look at the market today, if you look at the biggest companies out there, most of them only operate one or two titles successfully. So for us, King, we have multiple games and we are lucky to have a bunch of successful games. Right. But it's true that by far, Candy Crush Saga is the biggest game that we've made.
Yeah.
And that's a trend that you can see. If you look at the charts today, you know, I think in the top 10 highest grossing mobile games every year, you barely have maybe one or two new games that pop up. Most of them have been here for a long time. I mean, Candy has been here for 10 years. So as much as I understand the idea of diversification, when you decide to do that, what it means is that you're going to take some of your resources, some people who are going to have to relearn an entire new genre. They have to learn the mechanics, they have to learn the player preferences, and most importantly, you have to create a new brand as well.
Yeah.
And because you know what's super interesting now, I think, in the current gaming market is that it's becoming more and more easy to make a new game. You know, AI is here to help. And what it means is that a lot of smaller studios will be able to make high quality games relatively easily in the future.
Right.
So making the new product itself is going to be less and less of a challenge.
Yeah.
What's going to be very hard is to create a brand that people remember. So our approach, again, at Kim is that we are aware that Candy Crush is one of the most famous IPs in the industry. And we know how hard it is to create that. So we believe that instead of trying to completely go outside of what we know, we get probably more value out of a big focus on that IP. Not just the game. I mean, the game is 90% of what we do, but cherishing the IP is super important.
Right.
And you know, when you have a brand, it means something to people. You know, if you talk about Apple, for instance, Apple means sleek design, high end, and so on. And Apple just does that. It's the same for games. When you say Candy Crush, people think about puzzle, they think about casual gaming. And so we could do new games that would be called Candy Crush, but they cannot be shooter games. I mean, that would be surprising, right? We have to stay within something that would be familiar.
Right. No, I get what you mean. It's like, you know, staying within... Let's be honest, it's for you guys, it's a niche that's really worked. I mean, Candy Crush is the most successful mobile game, one of the most. You know, I don't really know the stats on that, but it's like you found, why would you stray from that? A model that's so successful. So I get what you mean, you know, when you say that.
It's a big niche. Yeah.
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 So interesting stuff. So can you, you know, you've talked a little bit about Candy Crush and what King does, but can you share an example from King where, you know, surprising player behavior, you know, might have impacted a development decision? Maybe it was something that, you know, something from the player that impacted, you know, the decision making when it came on the developmental level?
That's an interesting question. One example comes to mind. It's about ads. A few years ago, you know, ads were fast growing and a booming market for games, and we didn't have ads in Candy Crush. And to be honest, we were very cautious about that. We were not sure if players would like ads or not. And by default, we thought, yeah, probably not, because, you know, there is that perception that ads may be, I don't know,
doing the gameplay and all that. Yeah,
that's right. So we tested it. We started by putting completely optional ads, and it's still the case. I mean, we don't have interstitial ads, but we said, okay, out of 100 players, maybe 95 will never pay money. So they pay for free. They play for free.
Right.
Could we still make a better experience with ads? And so very progressively, we started, for some categories of players, we started showing some or offering some rewarded ads, but not very optimistic, to be honest. And then we realized that the players were actually using those ads in a very, very large quantity.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've worked on hyper-casual games before, and hyper-casual games, it's a different philosophy. You eat so many ads. But typically, a player would watch maybe 10, 12 ads per day on a hyper-casual games, impose on them.
Right.
In Candy Crush, it's completely optional. But we see people watching 20, 30 ads per day.
Yeah.
Which shows that actually, for those people who get the choice, it doesn't damage their experience. It seems to be enriching their experience.
I think the choice is the key, you know, differential factor there that you identified. It's like choosing to watch the ad rather than it being imposed on you. It's a big difference.
Probably. And yet, you know, I think I wouldn't set that as a rule, because I believe that there are markets, I'm thinking about India, for instance, where I think players are used to ads much more. And you know, in some markets, it may work even if it's interstitial.
Right.
And I think, like everything, it's something you want to measure before you decide. But if you start with a, you know, the answer already in your head, you may be wrong. So
that's interesting. So, you know, how do you think developers can sort of approach the integration of emerging technologies? I mean, we couldn't really have this conversation without bringing up things like AI and AR. You know, how can they integrate this into their games? What sort of exciting possibilities do you think these technologies can be unlocked?
Well, first, I wouldn't put AI and AR, VR in the same the same basket. For me, AR and VR are interesting technologies. And I have a VR headset, and I love it. It's fun and all that. But I think maybe we overhype that a bit, like NFTs and crypto for a while. And we made the mistake to believe that players would buy or play a game because it integrates the technology and not because it's fun. And so for me, AR and VR are a means to an end. So basically, you have a gameplay that requires AR, great, put AR. But don't build a gameplay around AR, because that's not going to be interesting.
Yeah.
So I would put it here. Now, AI.
That's a different story.
Yes. Yes. And I know I've read articles recently saying that AI has still not brought business value to companies and everything. And what I can tell you is that at King and obviously Microsoft, from day one, we've been actively looking into that. It comes with, you know, ethical and legal challenges that are very real, but There are many ways to integrate AI in your games or in your workflow. What comes to mind naturally is, okay, are you using Gen AI to create art or to create stuff like that? We don't do it. We may sometimes internally use, if you want to show, express an idea on a PowerPoint, maybe you can I use DALL-E to do something, but you're not going to release that. We don't. So for art, for instance, we don't use AI, but I guess many companies could. No, nothing prevents you from doing that. And it's a bit controversial because I know that AI basically is already creating some art, and that art comes from somewhere and everything. But and I think it's an individual choice. You can choose to use it or not. I know some companies will use it eventually. What we do at King is to use it more in our workflow. So it starts with, for instance, using AI to help us code or to help us make the code better. And then we, in our development process, sometimes we have some manual work that could be done faster with AI. And I can give you an example. As we mentioned, we do labels. That's the heart Candy Crush. People come to Candy because of the labels. And contrarily to what some people think, these labels are designed manually by actual designers who bring the quality that I don't think a machine could bring. So we have those great labels, but then we need to test them. So we have developed an AI tool that replicates the behavior of human players. And we run our labels through that AI tool, and very quickly we know if the labels will be hard enough or too easy,
Interesting.
and we can pick them. So we are saving a lot of time, and we can really improve the progression in the game thanks to that. So that's an example. It's not visible directly, but it makes us more efficient, and we have tons of things like that. So truly, I think AI is going to be a real game changer for gaming, not just for gaming,
Every
but
industry.
yeah, absolutely. You things that were complicated, technical, will be less complicated. And for instance, today with ChatGPT, you can generate. I mean, I don't know how to code. I can generate mini games just by prompting that on one HTML5, and you can play them. It's crazy.
It's a game changer for sure.
But it has big implications, I think, on the industry. Concretely, it means that it will get easier to make a game,
For sure.
which means that there will be more games.
How do you make your game stand out, in a market that's just completely saturated? That's another question, I guess, that we'll maybe
But
find.
that's right. I mean, that's a fundamental question. But you know what? I think it's, in a way, it's great news because my kids got Atari console, a retro gaming console
Oh,
for
nice.
Christmas. And we have a Xbox, PlayStation, with all sort of things. But those games back then were not complex. They were just all about the fun, all about the gameplay. And I think that over time we forgot a bit about that. We started to go into gameplays that may be less fun, but much more impressive with, cinematic stuff. And I have nothing against that. But now that those cinematic aspects are going to become easier to make, what's going to make the difference is the fun, finding the fun.
100%.
So, when I was at Riot Games, and I think it's true for every big game out there. The idea was to make games that were infinitely replayable, finding the loop that you will never get bored of playing. That's true for MOBA games like League of Legends. It's true for Minecraft, it's true for a shooter game like Call of Duty or Valorant, it's true
Right.
for Candy Crush, but it's true for chess, it's true for soccer. You know, it's like you change parameters, but the game itself is the same.
Right.
People who say, yeah, we're going to play soccer with cars. Okay, infinitely replayable. If you do that, you can find your niche. You can find your place on the market, but you will be able to sustain. I think progressively we're going to shift the resources towards more of the game design aspect of the game,
Right.
which is about finding that core loop that is really, really good, making the cinematic aspect of the game will probably become easier. But then what will be even more key is finding your community, keeping the community engaged,
Yeah.
building your brand actually. And if you manage progressively to build that strong community, then you're good to go. You know, if you build that trust relationship with the players, I think you will be good to go for 10 years at least. So, yeah.
So really interesting stuff there, Benjamin. And I want to ask you because obviously King, and you mentioned, AI making workflows easier and that sort of thing. But another thing that I sort of wanted to ask you is, I mean, you work for King who obviously deals with a lot of data. So, my question to you is many studios sort of leverage data to inform game design. How does King do that? How do they leverage data, but doing it to ensure that it doesn't stifle creativity and the ability to sort of experiment with new ideas?
Yeah, so that's a super important point. So first, A/B testing is key. Everybody should do that. There is no way to know if what you're doing really works unless you test it.
Right.
And at King, we have dozens of A/B tests running in parallel all the time. We can do that because we have a large player base. So even if we take a small portion of the player base, we can still get significant data, and we know if an improvement brings value, and that informs the design. Now you're right. Sometimes when you are too much about data, you forget about creativity, and you
Yeah.
forget to look at okay, what are the great things you could do. And like we said, I think you need to keep some of your roadmap for innovation. Not the how to do that well. I think what's super important when you aim for large innovation in your game is to de-risk that innovation, is to find a way to remove the unknowns. And so it all starts, in my view, it all starts with a design vision. You need to know where you want to go. You need to have that long-term perspective
Yeah.
and a thesis about what impact do you expect that to make to your game. Are
Right.
you designing something to increase, I don't know, retention, playtime, monetization? You need to know. You need to have a thesis for that. But then the mistake you can make is to take 5, 10 people, put them in a room for 6 months. They work, they ship, and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
That happens a lot. So what you have to do is to slice that big ambition into small pieces and ship every piece quickly.
Right.
For each of these pieces, you need to detect through data a signal that you're going the right track. You're on the right track. And then if you check the box, then you move on to the next step and so on and so forth. So if you do that, you can get a bit of both. And then I think there is another thing that I would like to say. It's about inspiration from other games. I
Right.
would put it this way. I've been many times in game teams or in companies where a competitor came up with an innovation. Something that really worked. It could be like loot boxes, could be the battle royale concept, many different things like that that truly brought something really new to the market. And also, I've been in companies like King or Riot where our games were copied by
I can
competitors.
imagine. Yeah.
So, and I would say, I don't think there is anything wrong in being inspired by someone else. And sometimes, we put a bit of ego in a game and say, ah, we are not like that. I do my own things. In reality, in the business of gaming, there is no value in an idea. There is only value in how you execute on that idea for your
Right,
specific.
but so refreshing to hear.
Well, yeah, and that's true. I mean, and it happens all the time because you never copy apple to apple. You will adapt it a little bit to your game so that it works. We do have a battle royale concept in Candy Crush. We have live ops now that, where you start with 100 players and level after level you have less. Well, you could say that's inspired by PUBG and that kind of yeah. But we did our own version of for match three and it works. So I think all these things are different ways to look at innovation in a game. Always you always need the data. I mean, honestly, if I had to set up a new game company tomorrow, of course I would have a great game team to make a great game, but you would need a great data team. That's
100%. Data is the new gold. That's all I keep hearing across every industry again.
absolutely.
So, last question for you here, Benjamin. And we always like to give a little bit of a, future gazing opportunity to our guests. So, we're in an industry that's rapidly changing. Mobile gaming is a rapidly changing landscape. So, what do you think might be the next sort of major disruption to the space? And how do you think studios can prepare for this?
I think of three main things. The first one is AI, and we talked about it. So AI essentially will, how would I summarize it? You can be a small company with no resources and create the same games as a large companies. That's essentially what it means. Maybe not quite now, but soon. So if today I'm a small company, I would completely embrace AI and look at how it can make me 10 times more productive. So you find the right talents, the right team, and you equip yourself with the latest AI tools. I think that's super important. If you're a large company, it's a bit the same, actually. If you don't embrace AI, you are at risk. Because you will progressively, there will be more competitors that will become more and more productive, and you have to do something about it. So I think that's a no-brainer essentially, but it's clearly a big, massive change. And just to elaborate a bit on that, we said more AI means more games, means that we are moving the challenge towards creating a strong community, a strong brand, but also more games means that being discovered becomes difficult. How do people know about your game? Well, they know through performance marketing. So, and that's not always good news because what we see is that the performance marketing investments required to grow your player base are increasing, and it's a fact, unfortunately. So I think what it means is that you will need to find budget essentially to be able to grow unorganically. And also, I think it means you need people who know about performance marketing. It's an art, especially because that leads me to the second point, data, user data. So I think what we see over time is that thanks to regulators, the users, the players are getting more and more control over their data. And I think it's great, by the way. Let's be clear, I think it's a good evolution. What it means, though, from a business standpoint, is that we are less granularly informed on people. We don't know. It's not easy to know if a person likes to play that kind of game, or if that person is in a specific country, it's becoming harder, and it's going to continue to be more hard. And I think it leads to two things. The first consequence is that if you can target people less, your targeting is less efficient. So you have to spend more money per new install.
Right.
So it's getting more expensive to get players. What it means is that you need to make games that monetize well. And you know, we tend to forget about that. But in reality, I think making money with a game is just a representation of the appreciation of the players. If they don't like your game, they don't pay. I mean, that's
essentially, that's
a fact of free-to-play games. So you need that, and you need experts in data and performance marketing who are going to be able to anticipate those changes so that you can mitigate that transformation. And I think the last point in mobile is the Digital Market Act, you know, the DMA.
Yes.
Which is the tip of an iceberg. Right. But still, what is DMA? DMA is a set of rules that come from regulators in Europe, and also the US are coming with their own things, and it's going to be progressively global. We've seen things in Korea and more markets where the regulators are trying to open the distribution market, essentially.
Right.
Now we have a few big players who also control most of the hardware we play on.
Yeah.
And progressively, this is going to be released and open, which means that new players in distribution will be able to enter both on Android and iOS. They will be able to drive traction by maybe offering value to the players. And as game developers, we will have more options to distribute our games with different margins, different ways. It could be direct to consumer as well. So I think this is good news, because it's good news for the players, more choice. And it's good news for game developers, because, you know, you will have more ways to be discovered.
Right.
I mean, it's something that China has been doing for ever. Actually, the distribution market has been open in China. And the Chinese gaming market is arguably a very successful one, because it's a massive one. So I think these three things are big changes for us.
Amazing. Well, I think that's a good punctuation point to end our discussion on, Benjamin. But thank you so much for what's been a super, super insightful discussion today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for all the listeners at home. That was it for this week's Mobilize and Monetize podcast.